We moved into the house on the edge of the old quarry during the mild start of autumn. My husband's gravel business had recently closed down and he had taken up a job in construction, which made us relocate to this quaint little town in Minnesota, where my husband was supposed to work on a new mall. The agent had mentioned the quarry's grim reputation casually, almost an afterthought among square footage and plumbing details. Locals called it the suicide spot, a place where despair seemed palpably embedded in the very air. We shrugged it off, swept up by the picturesque view and the promise of a new beginning. I liked it, away from the city, and the view from the house was serene. Snowy hills, quarry, a lake in the distance, and not many people around. Our daughter Emily seemed to resonate with her new room from the moment we stepped inside. At 7, she was vivaciously curious and quickly claimed the space with her sprawling collection of stuffed animals and books. But as night fell on our first day, the unsettling began. The house, with its creaks and sighs, felt unnervingly alive. I am not a sound sleeper, and I remember waking us in the middle of the night, thinking that a woman was looking at me through the window, but I shrugged it off. It was the third night when the terror truly took hold. Emily's screams jolted us awake. We found her in her bed, wide-eyed and trembling.
The lady with white eyes wants me to come under the bed. She scares me.
She cried out, her voice muffled against my shoulder. We assumed it was a nightmare, yet the fear in her eyes was disturbingly real. My husband Tom went under the bed to show her that there was no one there. She always had an imagination, so we didn't think much of it. But there was something about her description that unnerved me. Determined to ease her and our fears, we installed a small hidden camera in her room next day. What we discovered that night chilled us to our bones. The footage revealed nothing at first, just Emily tossing in her sleep. Then, abruptly, the blanket began to slide off her, as if pulled by unseen hands. Her little body shifted towards the edge of the bed, slowly, as though being dragged. Then, just as suddenly, she was violently pulled under. We rushed to her, finding her alone and terrified. My husband opened the camera's app on his phone and we were shaken. The live feed still showed movement, a flicker of something, a shadow that shouldn't have been there. On the small screen, a figure emerged, translucent and small, a girl hiding under the bed, her eyes hollow, her stare hauntingly fixed on the lens. There's something under there.
I see it, but how? There's nothing there.
We checked the room, every corner, under the bed, behind the curtains, finding nothing but the lingering cold of dread. Emily, inconsolable, clung to us, refusing to be left alone. We decided to stay in the living room that night, hoping safety was in numbers. The lights flickered ominously as we settled on the sofa, our eyes darting around the shadowed corners of the room. That's when the whispers started, a soft, lisping sound that seemed to seep out of the walls. Do you hear that?
It's like someone is crying.
The temperature suddenly dropped, and the whispers grew into wails. The TV turned on by itself, flipping through channels rapidly, stopping on a static-filled screen that seemed to pulse with a silent scream. I could feel the hair on the back of my neck rise as a cold hand seemed to brush against my cheek. Emily, between us, shrieked as a toy from her room came rolling into the living room, stopping at her feet. The room grew colder, the air thick with a palpable sense of despair. We huddled closer, our minds racing, hearts pounding, as the haunting continued to escalate, each moment more terrifying than the last. And then suddenly, the three of us fainted at the same time. When my eyes opened again, I saw a bloated man's fat, pale feet dragging across our living room floor. Outside, dawn's faint light began to filter through the curtains. We thought the worst was over, but the house, as if sensing our relief, tightened its grip on us. The windows rattled violently, as though something or someone was desperate to get in, or perhaps to keep us trapped inside. "We need to leave now." Tom freaked as well, as could clearly see the bloated man with white eyes and pale legs walking across our hall aimlessly.
But the car keys, they're upstairs.
I knew I had to retrieve them. Steeling myself, I ventured towards the staircase, each step creaking underfoot like an ominous drumbeat. The air was heavy, charged with a malevolent presence that seemed to watch my every move. As I passed Emily's room, the door slammed shut behind me. Heart pounding, I turned back to see the knob turning slowly. With no time to ponder, I pushed forward to our bedroom. Inside, the atmosphere was stifling, oppressive. I grabbed the keys from the dresser, and that's when I saw it in the mirror, a reflection that wasn't my own. Behind me stood a girl, her eyes empty, her mouth twisted in a silent scream. I spun around, but there was nothing there. The room felt suddenly colder, and I sensed a sorrow so deep it nearly dragged me down with it. I dashed from the room, keys in hand, the sounds of the house groaning under some unseen strain echoing around me. As I descended the stairs, a picture frame flew off the wall, shattering just inches from where I landed. The house was alive, angry, and didn't want us to leave. Back in the living room, Tom and Emily were huddled together, pale and scared. The bloated pale man still continued wandering aimlessly, now moving to the kitchen from our living room. We rushed to the front door, flinging it open, only to be met by an overwhelming force that slammed it shut again. The windows fogged over, as if iced from within, and through the mist, we saw figures, shadowy, indistinct, all staring back at us. Through the back! We scrambled towards the kitchen, the air filled with the sound of shattering glass and the house's persistent wail. The back door resisted at first, as if held by an unseen force, but with a desperate shove, it flew open. We spilled out into the chill of the early morning, the quarry looming ominously nearby, its dark waters still and silent. But even outside, the sensation of being watched didn't leave us. The girl appeared at the window, her sad, tormented eyes looking at us. We ran to the car, the engine sputtering to life as if reluctant to start. As we drove away, the house seemed to recede into the background, but the echo of the girl's wails followed us down the road. Our new beginning had turned into a horrifying ordeal, but we were alive. We survived the house by the quarry, but we would never be the same. The memory of that night lingered, a stark reminder of the thin veil between the living and the dead, forever etched into our minds. It was our first night in the new house that I had acquired from the bank for a steal, a charming old structure nestled on the outskirts of town I grew up in, surrounded by woods. My wife, Laura, and I were thrilled to finally move in, escaping the city's chaos for what we had hoped would be a peaceful rural life. It helped me reconnect with my mother, who briefly lived there about 3 decades ago for about a year while working 2 jobs after my dad walked out on us. This nutjob rancher had bought the property in a shady deal, so my mother was forced to move out. This is it, Laura. Just the fresh start we needed.
I know, it's perfect. I love it already.
As night fell, we settled in, the house creaking softly as if adjusting to its new occupants. We were just about to turn in for the night when the power suddenly cut out, plunging us into darkness.
James, did you clear the electricity dues of the previous tenant?
Yes, of course. It must be a fuse. I'll check the box in the basement. Grabbing a flashlight, I headed downstairs. The air grew cooler as I descended, the beam of my flashlight flickering across old stone walls. Reaching the fuse box, I flicked the switches, but the power remained off. It was strange. That's when I smelled it, a strange metallic scent that didn't belong.
Laura, do you smell that?
Yes, what is that? It's getting stronger.
She started coughing hard. The realization hit us both at the same time. Gas. We scrambled to open windows, but the smell seemed to seep in from the walls themselves. I grabbed Laura's hand, pulling her toward the front door, only to find it jammed.
It's sealed shut.
How? What the hell?
Panic set in as we tried window after window, finding each inexplicably stuck. It was clear. This was no accident. Someone had trapped us here. We covered our mouths with wet cloths, trying to filter out the toxic air, our minds racing for a solution. That's when we heard it. A soft, sinister chuckling coming from the shadows. A figure suddenly emerged and banged his fists on a glass window, wearing night vision goggles and a gas mask, his appearance as terrifying as his intentions.
Ah, the prodigal son returns. Welcome home.
His voice was muffled but clear, the threat undeniable. He began to circle us, moving with a predator's grace, his steps unnervingly silent.
Who are you? What do you want?
This is my house. You shouldn't be here.
No, it's our house. We bought it from the bank recently. There must have been a confusion.
Oh no, this is yet to happen.
He vanished as quickly as he appeared, leaving us coughing and disoriented. We needed to act.
We have to get out of here, Laura. I know about this guy, some survivalist nut job. He's one of those doomsday preppers. We need a weapon, anything. He could be crazy.
We tore through the kitchen drawers, finding a rusty old hammer and screwdriver. Poor weapons, but better than nothing. But that is when the second act of Rogan's twisted game began. A series of loud bangs echoed through the house as the pictures on the walls began to fall one by one, their glass cover shattering on the floor, the sound magnified in the eerie silence.
He's trying to scare us.
It's clearly working.
That is when both of our phones rang simultaneously. Cautiously, I answered.
Running won't help. I'm everywhere.
With each psychological jab, Rogan was wearing us down, terrorizing us with his omnipresence and sadistic games. We were trapped in a nightmare, fighting not just for our home, but for our very lives. The tension was palpable, our breath shallow and rapid as we navigated through the broken glass and oppressive darkness of our new home. Laura clung to my arm, her body trembling with each unfamiliar noise.
We need to keep moving. Find a place to hide until the police arrive.
I tried calling 911 during the banks, but there's no signal anymore.
That realization struck a new wave of terror in us. Rogan had likely jammed the signals, cutting off our last hope of quick rescue. Each step we took was cautious, avoiding the crunch of shattered glass beneath our feet, knowing that Rogan could be lurking in any corner with his night vision advantage. As we edged toward the living room, a sudden movement caught my eye. Rogan, his goggles reflecting the dim light from my flashlight, was closer than we'd anticipated. We ducked behind the sofa just as he swept through the room. His slow, deliberate steps were a psychological torment all their own.
What does he want from us?
Laura whispered.
He thinks we're trespassing on his life. We have to convince him otherwise or end this.
Emerging from our hiding spot, we made our way to the study, a room lined with bookshelves and old furniture, a remnant of the house's past owners, which now included Rogan. It was there we found his fourth psychological attack, a wall covered with photos of us, photos taken long before we'd moved in. Each picture was marked with red crosses, and some were defaced with angry words scribbled across our faces.
He's been watching us for a long time.
We're not just random targets. He planned this. With each revelation, the gravity of our situation sank deeper. We weren't only dealing with a madman, but a calculated, vengeful stalker who had lost everything and blamed us. Just then, a low hiss filled the room, another release of gas. But this time, it was accompanied by the soft flicker of flames from the fireplace. Rogan was escalating his tactics, using fire as his next tool of terror.
This is it, Laura. If we don't stop him now, we won't make it.
Armed with our makeshift weapons, we prepared to confront Rogan. We couldn't wait for rescue that might not come in time. Moving back through the corridors, we listened for any sign of him. The house groaned and creaked around us, as if mourning its own involvement in the night's horrors. Then, out of the shadows, Rogan appeared, charging at us with a ferocity that matched the wild look in his eyes. Laura swung the hammer with all her strength, catching him off guard and knocking the goggles from his head. Blinded by the sudden exposure to the dark, Rogan staggered back. I lunged forward, driving the screwdriver into his shoulder, pinning him against the wall.
This isn't over! This'll never be over! It's over for tonight!
Laura charged with the hammer again, hitting at his legs and shattering some bones. He fell right there. With Rogan subdued, she rushed to the phone in the kitchen, the line miraculously clear again. She called the police, her voice a mix of relief and lingering fear. As we waited for the authorities to arrive, we kept watch over Rogan, who groaned from his injuries on the floor. The police arrived within minutes, their lights piercing through the remnants of darkness. They took Rogan into custody, assuring us that the threat was over for now. As we stepped outside, the fresh air felt like a balm to our frayed nerves. The night had ended, but the memory of it would linger, a shadow over our new beginning.
Can we ever feel safe here again?
We'll make it safe, together. As dawn broke over the horizon, the light seemed to reclaim the house from the darkness of the night's events.